Well, as that slide says, my name is Amy Lansky, and I just first of all want to thank the NVIC for inviting me to speak. I've been a big supporter of the NVIC for many years, and what some of you may not know is that my husband, Steve Rubin, who's sitting over there, he's the one who maintains the VAERS vaccine injury database for the NVIC. He's been doing that even before it was the NVIC-sponsored database. So we're at the front lines. We get all the new data of vaccine injuries every month. We download from the CDC, and we get to see what's happening there. So we're very into this area and the NVIC. I'm so excited to meet Peggy O'Meara tonight, because it's because of Mothering Magazine that I even found out about homeopathy. So it was because of her that I'm here tonight. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to begin. Now, many of you may know my story, which is that I was a computer scientist in Silicon Valley, and I have two sons, Isaac and Max, and Max was a very early statistic in the autism epidemic, and I discovered homeopathy because of Mothering Magazine, and the rest is history, and he was fully cured of autism with homeopathy, a very unusual and amazing case, and that caused me to leave my career and write this book called Impossible Cure, The Promise of Homeopathy, which has become very successful in letting people know about homeopathy, just in general, but also for autism. So I'm going to begin my talk by telling you about Max's recovery, and I have a lot to say, so I'm going to go really quickly through these things. And then I'm going to do a really quick, brief introduction to homeopathy. And then I'm going to move into, you know, the interface between homeopathy and the whole vaccination issue. Three things in particular. How homeopathy can be used to prevent and treat the diseases for which vaccines are given. So homeopathy is an alternative to vaccination. And also homeopathy's success in treating epidemics historically. And then I'm going to go into homeopathy as a treatment for vaccine injury. So that's just the brief outline of my talk. So let's start with Max. This is my, actually you can see right there, there's Steve when he had shorter hair. It wasn't quite as gray. And there's Max on the left with the milk bottle. Okay, this is one of his things. He was totally addicted to milk. So here he is. Age 2.5 to 3 years, this was about the time period when we were alerted by the nursery school, something was wrong, we had to seek medical help. And there's my other son, Isaac, who's 3 years older. And you can see in the picture on the right, there was a tension in his body. And this was the time when he entered this, slowly veering into this sort of kind of a spacey, his own world. He was in his own world. So this is a really quick outline of what we did and how he progressed. At around age 2.5, 3, we were alerted to seek treatment. And this was back in 1994, before all of this, all of you would have been here. And before, you know, the only thing I could find out was about certain dietary things, the Feingold diet. And the first thing they said, cow's milk. And I went, muh, because Max was addicted to cow's milk. He would drink like eight bottles a day. So we eliminated the milk and also tried to not have anything with food coloring and also corn. And he was tested and he started getting speech and language therapy. And we also switched him to that point to a Montessori school. And after the milk was stopped, he did start having some speech, but he started having more characteristic autistic symptoms like echolalia, and he was in a therapy with a couple other autism spectrum kind of kids. At age three and a half is when I read that fateful article by Judith Reichenberg Ullman in Mothering Magazine, and I just don't know what it was, but I said, Steve remembers, I said, read this article, you know. It was like a three-page article on homeopathy for ADD and other behavioral problems. So within a week, we found this homeopath who had just come to the Palo Alto area, and we were very lucky. God was looking down on us, and the first remedy was the correct remedy in the right dose. And within a week, we were seeing very subtle but noticeable changes, so much so that we did not tell the therapist what we had done, but after the first few minutes of the next session, she said, "What did you do? Something was changed." He was able to suddenly hear and follow two instructions instead of just one instruction. So we just continued with this process. After a few months, it was just really a noticeable change, which was a very gradual process. That summer, we also tried osteopathic treatment. He had a series of treatments, which we noticed got rid of that tension in his body, and he started reaching out more for affection at that point. Within 9 months after doing homeopathy, his speech and language therapist, who was like the number one person who was dealing with kids like Max, and still is in our area, said, "Well, you know, he doesn't need this anymore, but we're going to keep him on the books for special education." And by age five, she retested him, and he was dismissed from eligibility for special education. He was testing above age level. And she told the county representative, it wasn't me who did this, it was homeopathy. So by age six, we switched him to a conventional private school. And at that point, his speech was normal. He seemed normal, but he was still rather immature. And I did not tell the teachers about his past. And one thing that what we saw with him and that people who treat autistic kids in the homeopathic community do see is that they might move from an autism diagnosis into a kind of a learning disability kind of diagnosis. And we were starting to see that for the first 3 years of grade school, we would get a call from the teacher going, "You know, Max is really smart, but sometimes he's just missing. There's just something odd. I can't put my finger on it." And then we just kept treating him homeopathically. I actually had him tested. At one point, he was like, "Well, he's sort of central auditory processing disorder, nonverbal. We can't, you know, we don't know what it is." Okay, well, we just kept treating. And these problems just disappeared over time. By fourth grade, we had no more communications from the teachers about any problem whatsoever. Although, still at about this age, I felt he was not as tuned in socially as some of the kids, you know. But by the time he went through puberty, I felt he was completely and totally free. I mean, he's a very popular kid. And so at age 18, he's 18 now. I'll give you, there he is. This summer. He just entered, he's a freshman at USC Film School, the top film school in the country in the animation program. He's very popular socially. He's an amazing guy. He has no deficits, you know, 800 on his math SATs too. And so we were really blessed. So that's our story. So this was enough to really change our life, my life especially, but my husband's life too. So I just want to point out some vaccine-related things along the way. Now, Max was not one of these kids who got a vaccine and the next day, you know, one eye was this way and he was, you know, screaming. It was like a gradual decline. And I suspect personally that it was an MMR injury. When I look back through my records, we gave him the MMR vaccine when he was still sick. He had had roseola, and I had delayed the vaccine about a week, but he was still not over this. And that's what I suspect. And when I look back through the videos, I feel like that's what happened. That's when the decline happened. Another reason I suspect a vaccine injury is that at age 5, although I refused vaccinations, I got convinced to give him the TB test. It's an injection in California. It's not that old time thing. And even the nurse missed when she was giving it to him, so she gave him twice, okay? And he had a marked regression at that point. And everybody went, like, what's wrong with him? And he had already made all this progress. But luckily, we put him back on the remedy. We actually had discontinued the remedy at that point, but we put him back on, and he snapped out of it within a week or two. So that was my second feeling that it was a vaccine injury. Another interesting thing is that over the years, I think stuff came out of his system. First of all, he did, at age 6, got whooping cough, and all of these events I consider fantastic things that he got these things. At age 8, he kept having this rash on his chest that looked like measles. He didn't actually get the measles, but I always wondered, what is this? What's this coming out? And at age 15, he got the mumps. It wasn't going around the school, but he got the mumps, and it was like, oh my God, it was wonderful. I was really happy he got the mumps. So now he's really immune to the mumps, right? So let's go into what's homeopathy. So let me start with what homeopathy is not, because in the media, people use the word homeopathy for natural medicine. So homeopathy is not herbalism, the use of plant tinctures. It's not a special diet or nutritional supplements, and it's not natural medicine. Homeopathy is a distinct form of natural medicine that is capable of treating the full range of physical, emotional, behavioral, mental problems. And it was developed in Germany in the early 1800s by Samuel Hahnemann and is popular all over the world. It is the second most prevalent medicine in the world. And it's integrated into the healthcare systems of many countries. And it's based on a single therapeutic law, whereas allopathic or conventional medicine is sort of take what works. In homeopathy, there's a single law that determines what medicine you give to a patient, called the law of similars. And the word homeopathy is essentially equivalent to this law, because homeo means similar, pathy means suffering. So homeopathy means similar suffering, the law of similars. And it says that if a substance can cause a certain set of symptoms in a patient, if the substance can cause a certain set of symptoms in a healthy person, and then you could prepare that medicine in a certain way, then that can treat those same symptoms in a sick person. So I'll give you an example. So something we all know about is what happens to us if we drink coffee. So coffee is actually a very strong medicinal substance. That's why we drink it. It causes alertness, elation, you know, happiness, excitement. Your mind is full of ideas, and also can cause heart palpitations, can cause diarrhea, actually, restlessness. So these are things that coffee can cause in a healthy person. So it turns out there's a remedy made from coffee called coffea cruda that can treat ailments that mimic this pattern of mental, physical, behavioral symptoms. So, for example, if you tend to suffer from insomnia and it has this pattern in that you have this elation and your mind's full of thoughts, palpitations, if that's the type of insomnia you have, then coffea cruda could be a remedy that could actually cure your insomnia problems, not just palliate them. But it's important to remember that remedies are never given or very rarely given in this crude form. They're developed in using a method called potentization, which I'll talk about in a second. Also, in other words, they're very highly dilute, and that's the controversial part about homeopathy. And the second thing is that remedies are not given, at least according to classical homeopathy, which is what I advocate, take this for that. So they're prescribed based on the whole symptom pattern of the person, not just got insomnia, take Coffea cruda. No. So, for example, another remedy that might be used for insomnia is Nux vomica, which is a very different pattern of symptoms. It's the kind of person who's really a workaholic and angry and can't sleep, or might often wake up in the morning and they start brooding about their work problems and can't fall back to sleep. And they so it's a very different kind of insomnia than a coffea cruda insomnia. So how does homeopathy work? Now, if you ask from the homeopath's perspective, what homeopathic remedies do is that they cure. They don't just suppress the symptoms. And they do this by stimulating the natural curative powers of your body and your energy body, because that's part of what homeopaths believe in, is the vital force, same thing as qi. So they stimulate this natural curative power of your body and your energy body to cure itself. And they do that because the remedy mimics the symptoms of your disease, it's actually stimulating your energy body with this pattern. This is the pattern, and it gives that pattern back to the body, and then the body will react to that pattern and say, oh, okay, now I will work against that pattern. I will react to this pattern. So it's something that Hahnemann called reaction-reaction. But the important thing, it's not the remedy that forces the body to do something. It's the remedy that stimulates the body and gives the body information, or the energy body information, that the body can then use to heal itself. Okay? Now, in contrast, most allopathic medicines are suppressive. And we call it antipathic, and that's why a lot of medicines are anti-this, anti-histamine, anti-diarrhea, anti-this, anti-that. It's because what they're doing is suppressing the symptoms, going against the symptoms that the body is expressing. So, because the body often works in this action-counteraction way, what does the body do with that? Well, it might just throw it off, and so then the symptoms come back again when they're done being suppressed. Or the body might counteract and make the symptoms even worse, right? So, for example, that's why when you take Afrin nasal spray, your nose gets clear, and they say don't take it for more than 3 days because then it can get even worse. That's because your body reacts against this suppression and makes the problem even worse. But what if the body can't do that anymore? What if the symptoms are so totally suppressed they can't come back? Then the disease can go deeper, become a more serious, deeper disease. And that is the real serious problem of suppression. And what homeopaths believe is the leading cause for chronic, or one of the leading causes for chronic disease in our society, because every medicine we take is suppressive. In particular, you know, my kids know all about homeopathy, and we watch those ads on TV, and they, you know, take this antihistamine, and by the way, you might get liver failure and blah, 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 blah. And we just kind of laugh because we know that's because of suppression. So because you don't want to have a stuffy nose, you can just die instead, you know. Or because you don't want acne on your face, you get suicidal depression. Because side effects are really the results of suppression. So another important thing about homeopathy is that it's holistic. And what that means is that you're not treating this part of your body and this part of your body. You're treating the whole person. So what homeopaths do, it's really all about pattern matching. A person is a pattern. I am in my pattern of disease. It includes my mental state, my emotional state, all my physical symptoms, my behavior, everything about me represents this pattern of my energy body, actually my vital force. Every remedy also has a pattern like this, and we discover this pattern by conducting what are called provings, where homeopaths usually volunteer and take these substances and find out what patterns they cause. And then the homeopathic treatment process is all about pattern matching. The homeopath discovers what pattern you have, and then they've learned about the patterns of all these remedies, and then the whole game is to find the one remedy that matches your pattern, and that will be the one that can cure you. And if they do find that remedy, or at least one that matches you pretty good, then you should also have a holistic response. Your whole vital force will respond. So not only will your complaint improve, but everything about you will improve. Your mental state, your sleep will improve, your menstrual cycle will improve, your digestion will improve. So that's the ideal, and that is possible with homeopathy. Like I said, I'm an advocate for classical homeopathic treatment, and what that means is that the homeopath selects one remedy that matches your pattern. Usually they conduct the first, and the most expensive appointment is usually the first one, because the homeopath will talk to you for 2 or 3 hours, maybe, at least 1 to 3 hours, and will really evaluate your case, often even after your appointment, to think about it. And they'll want to know everything, including vaccination problems, your whole family medical history. But the most important symptoms that you can give a homeopath that might lead him to the best remedy is something that's unusual. So if your kid's autistic, for example, it won't be just the common symptoms of autism. It'll be what's really unique about your kid, something that's very different or unique about your autistic kid. So those are the ones that can really help the homeopath find the best remedy. Then they select the remedy based on the law of similars, not based on testing or machines. This is classical homeopathy. And they will only give one remedy at a time, no mixtures of remedies. And the least amount of remedy necessary. And only repeat it and dose you based on your response. So this is classical homeopathic methodology. Now, the remedies come from many sources, anything in nature. So, of course, plants, animals. Many animal remedies are very important, from various snake venoms, insect venoms, mammal milks, everything. Minerals, metals, salts, gases. Also, disease products. These are actually really important remedies in vaccine injury treatment often. So remedies made from disease products like tuberculosis and gonorrhea, all those icky things, but they're really important. Also, remedies made from healthy bodily tissues and remedies made from anything else. So remedies made from the vaccines, thimerosal, adjuvants, drugs, etc. And the remedies are usually administered orally or in water, but can also be given through olfaction, which is like sniffing. This is much more rare for a very sensitive case. Or like you can use arnica gel. People use that. That's topical remedies. So, of course, the controversial part. How can homeopathy work? There's nothing there. It's so dilute. There's not even a molecule of the substance in the remedies. Well, science is starting to catch up with this very recently, just the past few years. So the remedies are made through this process of serial dilution and shaking. So let's say a C remedy, which you often see in the health food store. A C means a dilution of 1 to 100, because C is Roman numeral for 100. And so this, let's say a 12C, the dilution would happen 12 times, 1 to 100. And in between each dilution, it's shaken up vigorously, and this is very important. Now, once you get past 12C, you're beyond Avogadro's number, which is the point at which there's likely to be even a single molecule of the substance in there. But recent studies have shown that ultra dilutions do carry something in them that's actually measurable. There was a paper, now I know this is low, some of you can't see, but there's a paper that came out done by Rustam Roy, who's a professor at Penn State, who's like one of the world's leading experts in water cluster formation. and they were able to use laboratory instruments to see signatures, and these are in homeopathic dilutions beyond Avogadro's number. They could tell the difference between, let's say, two different homeopathic remedies, because they had different signatures in these instruments, as well as different potencies, different levels of dilution of these remedies. So this is a very significant thing. The other thing is that there's been research going on for many years by non-homeopathically related people. Jacques Benveniste, it's been replicated, it's been suppressed, that shows that any substance can be potentized through this process and still have the effects of the original substance. What does that mean? That means you could take any drug that people are charging gobs of money for and make billions of doses for like nothing. So this information has been completely suppressed. However, this result was just came out, there was a paper came out a month ago by this guy, Luc Montagnier, who's a Nobel Prize winner, who has replicated this kind of result of using ultra dilutions. Okay. You can tell I'm very excited about this. Okay, so homeopathy is not new to the United States, even though it's new to most of us. And it was a very popular form of medicine in the 1800s. And why is that? Because homeopathy was incredibly successful in treating epidemics. So now we're going to get into the vaccination issue. In fact, there's a monument erected of Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, stands at the corner of 16th Street in Massachusetts in Washington, D.C. And it was erected by and dedicated by President McKinley in 1900. It was used in the armed forces in World War I. That is the history of homeopathy in this country. It has a long and venerable history in this country. And one of the reasons is that most of the homeopaths of the 1800s were doctors who left allopathy and became homeopaths. And that's one reason the American Medical Association was formed, was to combat this phenomenon, because they were trying to combat homeopathy. And they made it illegal for their members to associate with homeopaths. Oh, they couldn't be a member of the AMA if they associated with homeopaths. So homeopathy's success in treating these epidemics started with Hahnemann in the 1813 typhus epidemic. And homeopaths had an amazing success rate compared to their allopathic counterparts. The yellow fever epidemic in the United States, allopaths, a death rate of 15 to 85%, homeopaths 5 to 7%. Diphtheria, 83% death versus 16% among homeopaths. And let's look at the bottom one, which you might not be able to see, the 1918 flu epidemic, 30% death rate among the allopaths, 1% among homeopaths. And by the way, the primary remedy in that epidemic was gelsimium. Homeopathy's also been successful as a prophylactic. And there were two studies done in South America. There is a very prominent homeopath named Dr. Ezeaga, who did these studies. In a 1957 polio epidemic, 40,000 children were treated prophylactically with a homeopathic remedy, and there were zero cases of polio. In a 1974 meningitis epidemic, you can see there 18,000 children were treated with homeopathy, and there were four cases. So there was the rate of infection of meningitis was 25 times in the non-treated group than the homeopathic group. So there's been studies, not in this country, but there's studies. So how do homeopaths prevent and treat epidemic diseases? The usual approach is something called the genus epidemicus. And what that means is it has to be done when the epidemic is happening. Homeopaths will take the case of several patients, see what the symptoms are that these patients are experiencing, and not just the common symptoms, but like those really specific symptoms like the mental state of the patients. Did it come on quick or slow? Are the patients prostrate or are they very restless? Are they thirsty or thirstless? What are the specific locations and sensations of the pain? It has to be very specific information that's usually not given out by the government, for example, about the swine flu. And then based on this information, they'll pick two or three remedies that match this pattern, and usually those two or three remedies are, they're called the genus epidemicus. Those are the genus epidemicus remedies, and they will be the ones useful for treating this epidemic. And then it's easy for the homeopath, once they know this, because they can just say, oh, it looks, they only have to differentiate between three different remedies. And they can also be used prophylactically. So a lot of people talk about this notion of homeopathic vaccination. Now, experience has shown that giving a person a remedy made from the actual disease product can work. So there was a study done by Wayne Jonas in the Army Medical Hospital here in this area. It was a lab study done where they were they treated lab mice with a nozode for this disease called tularemia. And the homeopathic nozode, in potencies beyond Avogadro's number, by the way, was 22% effective in preventing death in these lab mice. But in general, this approach is not as effective as the genus epidemicus approach when you really know the characteristics of a specific epidemic. Some practitioners have also been known to use techniques like this where you give these nozode remedies, these are remedies made from the diseases, in a kind of routine vaccination-like fashion, and they claim success. So this is not considered classical homeopathic care, but I just want to put it out there that people have used this technique a long time and have claimed success with it. Now, here are just some commonly used remedies for all those these various diseases that people take vaccines for. And and these are not the nozode ones. These are other remedies that match, they're common matches. And this is not exhaustive. I just put up some of the common ones. And all I'm trying to say here is that homeopathy does provide an alternative to vaccination. I want you to point out, too, this influenza set right there. It's very likely that this swine flu epidemic will be treatable by the remedies in this set. The three most commonly recommended ones right now or people are positing are Nux Vomica, Arsenicum Album, and Gelsimium. I personally am putting a word out there for Nux Vomica because 4 days ago I was in bed with 101 fever and I was having symptoms. I don't know if I had swine flu. I was sick and I took Nux Vomica and I'm here today. I'm fine. So still my nose is a bit stuffy still, but other than that, I'm fine. So now I want to talk about vaccine injury treatment. Actually, one of the very first people to talk about injury from vaccine was a homeopath named James Compton Burnett in around the turn of the 20th century when he was talking about vaccine injury from the smallpox vaccine. So homeopaths recognized the dangers of vaccination early on. And it's important to know it's all about susceptibility. Not everybody who exposed to an epidemic gets sick. Not everybody who takes a vaccine is immunized. Not everybody who takes a vaccine gets injured. And your response to anything, like a disease or a vaccine, depends on your susceptibility to the vaccine or the disease. If you catch and recover from a disease naturally, you are susceptible to it. And from a homeopathic kind of jargon point of view, that susceptibility was fulfilled, so you're no longer susceptible and you're immune to it. Your response to a vaccine will depend on how susceptible you are to the disease, to the vaccine. But sometimes, so for example, you might get the vaccine and it didn't even give you immunity because you're just not susceptible to the vaccine or the disease. You know, it just sort of falls off of you. But some people, it combines with their current disease state to create a chronic, combined, deeper state of disease. And that's what we see with these vaccine-injured kids. They have a new, deeper, chronic disease state. And luckily, our experience is that the ongoing constitutional homeopathic treatment can decrease susceptibility and improve the general health picture for people. So treating vaccine damage, I just want to point out that I'm not practicing homeopathy. I never treated autistic kids myself. I'm more out there telling people about it and giving people referrals. So if you want to email me, I'll try to give you a referral to a practitioner. That's what I do all the time for free. That's how I'm giving back to the world. So the first, and in my view, the best approach to treating vaccine damage is see a classical homeopath and get good constitutional treatment so that you're based on your overall symptom pattern, so that your vital force can be improved, your state can be improved so that your body can heal itself. And by that, I even mean chelate itself. Okay, so if that works, that is the best approach. Another important tool is called isopathic treatment. So if you know that you were poisoned by some substance, you know that you were poisoned by this vaccine because the next day your kid was sick, you know, or you took this drug or anything happened to you and you know you're poisoned by X, then a remedy made from X can help cure you of this problem. And that's called isopathic treatment. Another approach that people use is where they use remedies that are based on just experience. People know that these particular remedies are useful for correcting vaccine damage or are useful for treating specific organs. So there's all kinds of approaches that people use. How much more time? I only have one more slide. Okay. People always ask me, what about all the other things I'm doing for my kids? What are the interactions? So homeopathy is a very gentle form of medicine. It's stimulating your vital force. It's sort of a subtle, gentle thing. And the cures are, if they're good ones, if they're ideal, are gentle and gradual because your body is curing itself. It's healing itself. But that means is that if something is a very jarring thing to your system, that can antidote the effects of the remedy. So I like to say to people, it's like you push a ball and you put the ball in motion. And if something whacks the ball, it kind of stops it from moving. So common antidotes are very penetrating smells. A homeopath might tell you avoid like camphor or tea tree oil or some coffee, or dental procedures. But things will only antidote you if you are susceptible to it. So if you're not affected at all by going to the dentist, it's not likely to antidote you. It's really also individual to the person. Things that work very well with homeopathy, though, are these just sort of more gentle things like osteopathy or chiropractic, Reiki, diets, behavioral therapies, and many supplements. But some things like chelation, which are very more harsh on the body, can antidote the effects of homeopathic treatment. But if you really want to do that, then you can work with your homeopath and they can, you know, give the remedy more frequently, work with you to overcome anything you're doing that can antidote the remedy. So just tell you the homeopath what you're doing and they'll help you work with it. So just some helpful reading. I really do recommend you buy and read my book and check out the website. There's tons of information, including 4 years of free radio shows that you can listen to. Also, this book is excellent, called Vaccine-Free Prevention and Treatment of Infectious Contagious Disease with Homeopathy. And a great reference book, too, on influenza is The Homeopathic Treatment of Influenza. So I also want to put a plug in for the National Center for Homeopathy, which I'm on the board of. It's a great organization, and if you join, you get their great magazine called Homeopathy Today. You'll learn a lot about self-treatment from that magazine, and there's my website. So that's it. Thank you.